Jonathan Miles has a book out. It's called Want Not. And this is a great book. You got to read this. He is the author of the Dear American Airlines. You may have read that one. This is his latest one. And he's with us now from Hazelhurst in Mississippi. So he's back home. All right, Jonathan, how are you? Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah. So how does a Southern boy know so much about New Jersey? Is the question.
That's where I live these days.
Yeah. You learn fast, though, huh? You seem to know the ins and outs of New Jersey. Because this basically is an homage to all the possibilities of Jersey life in Whatnot, don't you think?
That's right. It's my Valentine to my adopted home state.
Yeah. Are you from Oxford or are you from Hazelhurst, I presume?
Oxford is where I lived for the most of my life.
Yeah, because I saw that the Square Books there had a notice, they call you Johnny, so I know you're from there.
That's right. No, I'm in Hazelhurst right now because I'm actually in central Mississippi at a deer camp.
You're at deer camp?
I'm at deer camp.
How cool.
But the deer camp doesn't have a phone, so I had to come to a friendly motel.
So is that fun or what? Are you having fun?
Yeah. Although I'll tell you, if you want to see a skeptical expression, go to a motel in full camo and tell them you need a room just for a little while to make a phone call.
Right. And, of course, no one else comes in, so they really know what you're up to in there. Johnny. Now, Johnny Miles in the hotel room there by himself for a short time. So that's cool. And now, but you were you the drinks guy at the New York Times?
I was for 4 years. It was a great job.
Yeah. So that was a stepping stone.
It was. I had the best beat at the Times. I was writing every 2 weeks about a new cocktail, and I did that until I ran out of adjectives.
Yeah. What's the best thing you can say about a cocktail? I mean, a good ad. Give me some good descriptives.
Well, at a certain point, if you're trying to describe gin, you just run out. You know, cedar and all the flavor notes. And
yeah.
Ultimately, I heard a story once about a travel writer who retired because he said he just couldn't find a new way to describe a beach.
You can count the grains of sand, but that gets old.
Right.
Yeah, and the drinks. So now, did you come right from Mississippi to the drinks editor at the New York Times? How did that work?
There was a brief interlude. I left Mississippi and did freelance journalism for a while, and then the drinks column opened up, and I grabbed it with both hands. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, writing fiction,
yeah.
Buying in the meantime.
So all this while, you had the fiction thing going.
Yes.
Was that on the back burner or was that on the front burner? Or what burner do you use?
It depended on the day.
Yeah.
You know, when I was writing nonfiction, I desperately wanted to be writing fiction because I could make it all up. Mm. While writing fiction, I desperately wanted to be writing nonfiction because I knew exactly where the story was going.
Yeah. So now, Deer Camp, so this sort of, the story here, one of the big factors in this story is recycling a used deer. It's all about things being recycled and thrown away and reclaimed and so forth. The major one seems to be this deer. Roadkill.
There was. I have a character who hits a deer one night coming home and finds it just incredibly wasteful to leave it, and so puts it in the back of his Jeep and takes it home and cleans it with the aid of his neighbor, which is actually based on something that happened to me.
It did.
I hit a deer one night and felt the same thing. This seems horrible. To just leave it, so I put it in the back. I was in my wife's car at the time. I put it in the back of her car and drove it home. We were living in sort of the orbit of New York City at the time, in a neighborhood, and I figured I would just hang it from the fire escape and clean it. sort of like hanging it from the basketball hoop.
Yeah.
And that ended up with one of the great fights of my marriage.
Yeah. Really, what was that over?
She just didn't think it was right to hang a deer from a fire escape in New York and clean it. I think she, you know, we were already from Mississippi, so there was some neighborly concern.
You didn't want to stress the point, I guess.
That's right.
And now in Mississippi, would that be unusual to see a deer from a fire escape?
Well, the fire escape would be the unusual thing.
Yeah, because you probably don't have them. Too many of those. Okay, so that'd be. But ordinarily not. Well, that's a great scene. In fact, you know, this Dr. Elwin Cross, Jr., He's like my favorite character in here. But actually, his dad is maybe my favorite character, Senior. But I think he should have his own series of books.
Senior was, he has Alzheimer's, and yeah. Which made it a very difficult character to write, to be in that head. And you know, one of the things I wanted to explore with that is this is a book about what, you know, why we want the things we want and why we keep the things, you know, why we keep some things and dispose of other things. And for him, it was his memory that he was not in control of what he chose to keep and what he chose to dispose of.
Yeah. And you know what? You totally got inside his head. You nailed it. Because, I mean, I don't have Alzheimer's yet, but you do forget, one or two things just with age alone. And I thought you totally nailed it. You got inside his head and all his frustration because he was a historian, and he was still working on his great treatise, right? His great work of his life, and could not recall things, or he would start ideas and he would get lost in the idea that he started. It was absolutely amazing, I thought.
Thank you. That comes from my mother has Alzheimer's, which is. Oh. A terrible disease, and it's horrible, and I love her dearly. And I think part of writing that was a way of trying to figure out what is happening in her brain when I speak to her. One of the things about Alzheimer's, though, that I find people sometimes will say, you know, this book made me laugh, and this book is funny, and I think, you know, part of that is my reaction to Alzheimer's, which is horribly tragic, and yet at the same time, sometimes so absurd that your reaction can only be to cry or to laugh. My father passed away years ago, but that is not a fact that my mother is able to hold in her head very well. So to anyone who has ever had to tell a parent that the other parent is dead, you can imagine having to do that three or four times a week. So we tend not to tell her. But at one point a few years ago, she said, you know, your father is not sleeping in the bed with me. And she had a roommate at the time in assisted living, and she said, and that means, and, you know, drew the implication. Now, I then am in the very awkward spot of having to try to defend my father against suspicions of infidelity without being able to deploy the really great alibi that he has in that he's no longer alive.
Yeah.
And you know, you can either cry at the situation or you can laugh at it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that, like that blues line, you know, laughing to keep from crying.
Yeah. Or my mother's line, actually. She said, you don't know whether to laugh or cry. That was like her mantra, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's my mantra, I think, in looking at life and writing about it as well.
And, you know, and it's not just, you are really able to get inside a character. It's an outstanding quality for a writer, I mean, but it's really almost unique because you can be a male character, your woman character in there, Micah.
Yes,
you seem to be, you seem to totally inhabit her, and I mean that's not easy sometimes. You know, Updike was always accused of having like no sense of female characters whatsoever. You know, he was often criticized for it, and he was a great writer, but you seem to be able to inhabit anybody.
That for me is the joy of writing, is that, you know, to sort of inhabit another person. Mm-hmm. My God, because I certainly don't want to inhabit me all the time. So that,
no.
You know, being able to sort of get inside these made up people and to figure out why they see the world in the way they do, that to me, that's where the pleasure comes from.
Yeah. Well, you really are able to nail it. And that cup, Micah and Talmadge, and he's from the South, I guess. And they're sort of dumpster divers in New Jersey, because this is all about waste not, want not. I mean, that's the title of it, all this stuff that people throw away and stuff that they try to reclaim. And so they're an interesting couple. And
they
then,
are. Micah is what I suppose would be called a freegan these days, freak being a mashup of the word free and vegan. And it's people who, for ecological reasons, as a kind of philosophical stance, scavenge from dumpsters and trash bins for their food as a way of reclaiming the astounding waste that we as a society produce.
Yeah.
And that's how they live. That's how they live their lives off the grid, so to speak.
Yeah, but she's interesting because she's not someone who's just adopted this, you know, in graduate school or something like that. She grew up having nothing and having to forage and sort of live under very difficult circumstances. So, I mean, that is really, she's for real in this whole thing.
She's hardcore. Talmadge, her boyfriend, is a lot less hardcore.
Yeah.
And continues to lose that core as the novel progresses. It's one of the things I wanted to explore with them is, you know, how we all have our principles and how much we're willing to sacrifice and hew to those principles. And she certainly is the epitome of someone who will not diverge from her principles.
Yeah. And then Elwin Cross Jr., the son of the father with Alzheimer's, he's a doctor of linguistics, is that right?
Linguistics, yes.
Yeah. So that's rather interesting because he's on this project. His thing about, you know, burying or wasting or whatever is actually radioactive waste. He's on this project where they're burying all this waste in Carlsbad Caverns, right?
Yeah, in New Mexico.
In New Mexico. And his, why is he on that panel that's supposed to decide what to do about that site?
He's been asked to join the panel as the linguist who will tell them what language they should write the warning for this nuclear waste site that will last for 10,000 years,
right,
which is a bit of a puzzle for him because no language obviously has lasted even a fraction of that time.
Yeah.
And so what do you put on this hazardous material that is going to be legible in 10,000 years?
Yeah.
And ultimately, you know, people come up with strange symbols and, you know, sad faces and scared faces. And it becomes, how do you communicate with deep time? And for Elwin, it sort of becomes this existential crisis. Like, really, this is our first effort to communicate to future civilizations, really, this deep in time, and it's a warning sign on our trash.
Right. And that's all basically we leave of our society or our culture, basically, is this radioactive waste.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty sobering idea.
And this panel or this deep sites or whatever it's called, this actually exists.
Yes, yeah. It was completely based on a real-life panel that came up with some extraordinary designs and ideas. But ultimately, I think the funding was cut at some point.
Oh, yeah, so it never got...
Yeah.
But, you know, and they decided to go in with all the major languages, there were five major languages, and Navajo.
Yes.
And, you know, I absolutely love the Navajo statements on that placard.
Yeah, as a way of as a nod to the land, the original owners of the land where we're burying all this waste.
I mean,
there are so many layers of irony in that.
Right.
Thank you, Navajo Nation. We're gonna put our hazardous waste here.
Right on your sacred ground.
Yes. Yes.
From the novel, it says that this place is best shunned. Sending this message was important to us. We considered ourselves to be a powerful civilization.
Yeah.
I love that. And that's in Navajo. Now, so tell us again now the thinking behind this. All these, you have these disparate, by the way, stylistically now, everybody is doing this now, aren't they, in terms of writing? They have these separate stories going on, like four or five separate stories going on. And as in the course of the novel, you try to figure out what they have in common, or when they meet, or when they converge. That's kind of fashionable now, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it is.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm sure I was influenced by that. But for me, it also became I saw the ending first. It came to
I
me
see.
as a kind of almost like a little vine clips get in my head, and I saw the ending.
Yeah.
And so the process for me was trying to figure out how did these people meet. And so it's sort of tracking back and
that's interesting.
And then putting them in their various positions and then seeing how they ultimately will converge.
So you're not a writer who starts off with a lot of ideas going and characters going and doesn't really quite have an ending until he gets there.
No, I have to have the ending. For whatever reason, it's just how I'm wired. And I once heard a writer, I think it might have been Richard Russo, I'm not sure, who described his process being very similar as throwing a pebble into a pond.
Mm-hmm.
That's his ending, and the writing process was swimming and, you know, mucking all over the bottom trying to find that pebble.
Well, that's pretty good, man.
Yeah.
Hard to write under those conditions, though, I would think.
Underwater, it is very hard to write.
Yeah. And so the want, explain to us the thesis, though, behind the want not part of it.
Well, want not was really, you know, I think when I start a novel, there's usually some questions that I want to ask, perhaps not answer, but ask. And one of those was simply, you know, why do we want what we want, and then what do we leave behind?
Right.
What are we leaving behind, both personally and as a society? And what mark are we leaving on the world? And that became, and when I started thinking about that, it became, I realized that so what so many of us really are leaving is just piles of stuff. Mm-hmm. And what is, you know, what does that say about us? And what is that, why are we, why do we accumulate that stuff? And why is that, you know, why is that what we leave behind?
Yeah. In fact, Elwin himself is basically a hoarder. He saved all the stuff from his marriage, and he has to ask his wife's permission to get rid of any of it. But at some point, he puts all his stuff in Craigslist or something, doesn't he?
Yes, yeah. He sheds.
He sheds.
Yes.
And that's a tremendously liberating feeling, actually, to be able to get rid of this stuff.
It is. It is. I mean, anyone who's ever done that knows that feeling of just that, you know, when you just get rid of whatever, your past, your stuff, you hit reboot, you refresh.
Yeah. The ultimate being that deer meat. He still had a lot of the deer meat left in his freezer.
He did, which he's finally able to also put on Craigslist and get rid of.
The good stuff.
Yeah.
He said it was butchered by the vehicle itself, so that was good.
That's right.
Yeah. And, I really like him. So, can we bring him back? Is it a possibility of bringing back Elwin?
I guess there's always a possibility. You know, you wonder with these characters. You finish a novel and you see them sort of in your imagination just standing there saying, "Well, you know, we're still here. What's next?"
Yeah.
And it's hard to fire them all.
Yeah. Yeah. What do? Do they die when you're done writing about them? That's kind of a scary thought.
No, they just sort of loiter around the house.
Oh, and by the way, speaking of the deer hanging from the thing with a motorized removal of the skin, did that happen to you as well?
I have done the motorized removal. that is a very effective way of getting a deer. It requires a four-wheeler and a golf ball and a little bit of rope.
Okay. A four-wheeler,
yeah.
A golf ball, and a little bit of rope. For those of us who have never tried this, or maybe thinking about it, may have a deer hanging from the hoop or whatever. For example, what's the golf ball for?
Well, the golf ball is just a little weight you can put inside the skin in order to tie a knot around the rope,
at
the other end of the rope being on the four-wheeler, and that way, if you pull it slowly, the skin will just come right off the animal. I hope no one's eating their breakfast. Yeah, the skin will just come right off the animal fairly smoothly.
Yeah, it was difficult because very nearly the novel peaked too early with the removal of that deer skin by the four-wheeler. You know,
I do believe I wrote the longest deer skinning scene in literary history.
I know.
That was my ambition.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's sort of true of your writing. I mean, you don't let anything go in your writing. People are, you know, there's nothing left to chance in your writing. I mean, when you describe someone's thoughts or someone's actions, you go through it step by step. And it's really amazing, actually, because then you get a tremendous sense of reality of what's happening.
Thank you. That is, again, that's just inhabiting those characters and yeah. letting them talk to you. And again, that is such, that's the pleasure.
Yeah. So is there interest in Wantnot for any other further uses, such as film or TV?
There has been some scuttle on the film side.
Yeah.
That's something that's completely foreign to my thinking. I don't, you know, I look at it and I don't see it, but
yeah.
But I'm grateful that others do.
Yeah, and why is it you sound nothing like a guy from who was in Hazelhurst, Mississippi?
that's from being in New Jersey for these years in New York. Yeah.
Really? How long did that take? Can you say anything that sounds Southern?
I think the golf ball and the four wheeler was probably.
I know, but it sounds like a guy from New Jersey saying it. That's a little. Well, it's a great book. It's called Want Not, and it's let's see what label you're on there. You're on HMH. Is the label. And Jonathan, it's a pleasure talking with you. And now, what's next in deer camp right now? What do you do next?
Well, hopefully there'll be a golf ball and a four-wheeler and get on the ground.
Have you been out there yet?
I have, yes. Yeah. And I have a 10-year-old son who's on his first deer hunt. So this should be fairly momentous for us all.
Fantastic. Well, good luck out there.
Thank you so much.
Jonathan Miles, ladies and gentlemen. Want Not is the book. All right, he's out there at deer camp. How about that? How many of you have gone to deer camp? Yeah. What goes on at deer camp? You mean, do you play, just drink and play cards? Is that pretty much it? Is there any deer hunting involved? What? messing around? You can't say, I understand. Okay, never mind. I see you're there with family. But really, what goes on at deer camp? Deer camp itself, I mean. In the deer camp. It's just drinking and playing cards, right? Pinochle, some play pinochle, some play...
Cooking.
What? Cooking? Frozen food, I bet. Nothing you shoot, I hope. Okay. All right, so there you have it.
There you have it.
There you have it.
Yeah,
are you there?
Sir. I'm good.
You've never been deer hunting, have you?
No.
Can you take a shotgun? You got a shotgun, I know that. But you can't take a shotgun deer hunting, can you?
Well, you know, one time I said you can't, but yeah, you can. You could, sure.
You can take anything now, I guess.
Well, you use the slug or whatever. You don't use the buckshot when you're...
No, you don't want to just buckshot them.
No.
Because then you got to pick all that out of the rump.
That's right. Then you're eating it and you chomp down.
Bad enough in a pheasant, but...
Or a goose.
Yeah. Okay, there. Glad we had this little talk. This really was engaging, wasn't it? Two guys talking about nothing they know anything about. Okay. Love that when that happens.
I don't know anything about deer camp.
Yeah. Jeff, you hunt, though, right?
No. I've shot a shotgun before.
Oh, wonderful. You shot a shotgun.
He has turkeys, wild turkeys in his backyard.
Yeah?
And deer, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
In Brookfield there?
Yes.
Are they escaped from the zoo or what?
I don't think so.
No? Oh, very amazing. Okay, don't shoot them. Just call the hotline, the zoo hotline, whenever you see something like that. Okay, and this little tune here, anything from the Sound of Music? I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, no. No, it's not.
Yeah,
I don't think I know any songs from The Sound of Music.
You don't? Could you learn one, maybe, quick?
Maybe. Not right now.
Can you finger your way through one? Maybe. I mean, it's not that
finger
hard.
Finger my way through one?
No. Yeah, I mean, it's just
I do that in every tune.
Okay. All right, so this is the song then.
This is from a movie called You Only Live Twice.
Oh, the Bond thing. Sounds good. John Tulane, Jeff Hammond on the bass.